It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we take a look at the political evolution, power, and success of the National Rifle Association.
First, 2014 was a huge year for the American auto industry. Despite outrage over numerous safety recalls, American car makers posted their best year in nearly a decade, selling around 6.5 million new automobiles. That's about 1 million more than in 2013.
Now, as we enter 2015 with low gas prices and a strengthening economy, will we see even better sales in the coming year? And because of those low gas prices, will large cars like SUVs and pickups come to rule the day once again?
Joining us now to break down these questions is Jessica Caldwell. She's a senior analyst at Edmunds.com. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with what happened in 2014. We had those safety recalls, consumer outrage, and yet American automakers did pretty well. How come?
They certainly did do really well, and I think the simple reason is a lot of people needed new cars, and not only did they need new cars, they felt better about the economy in general. I think things in general have improved over time, so people feel more comfortable buying a car, and also at the end of the year, sales were definitely helped by the low gas prices witnessed across the country.
And what about those safety recalls? Did they not have as big an impact as we might have thought?
Well, I mean, I think that they did. The problem is that there's been a lot of recalls over time. I mean, if you do recall the turmoil that Toyota went through back in 2010 with their recalls, it was so much news. And then this year with the GM and then the Takata airbag, I think a lot of people started to tune it out. And at the end of the day, people need cars. I mean, they need cars to get to work, to get to school, wherever they need to go. So if that's the case, they're going to buy a car regardless of what's going on, I think, in the news about these recalls.
So do you see this then as primarily a story about consumer confidence being restored?
It is really a story about consumer confidence. I mean, auto sales were so low, for so long. I mean, they hit the bottom back in 2009 at 10.4 million compared to this year at 16.5. I mean, that's a huge difference. So it definitely has been climbing since then. And a lot of times cars are the second largest purchase that most people are going to make. Some people the biggest purchase that they're going to make. And you have to be confident in the economy and your job and your own economic situation to buy a car. So I do think that this year in terms of auto sales really shows the strength of the American consumer.
If we zero in on what it is that exactly sold in 2014, what sticks out to you?
Well, I think 2014 will be known as the year of the light truck. And when I say light truck, I mean pickup trucks, SUVs, and vans. I mean, they outsold cars in every month of 2014. And that's the first time that's happened since 2004. So it's been nearly a decade. And you look at that car versus truck gap, it is just widening over time. So I think that is, really the predominant force in 2014 is the return to, SUV and truck sales. And people are buying different SUVs than they once did. I mean, these aren't gas guzzlers. A lot of SUVs are smaller. They're more fuel efficient. Compact SUVs did really well. So those smaller ones, those really drove those numbers. So I think that, those cars are definitely popular, amongst Americans, and it certainly showed in the sales numbers in 2014.
Well, and so here we are in 2015. We're still seeing low gas prices. Do you expect to see that trend continue then?
I think with low gas prices, we're going to see that truck trend continue. A lot of people like these cars. I mean, Americans want larger cars. I mean, I think that, we're forced to downsize, and some people do have to make, smaller decisions. But I think in general, people want, a larger vehicle, and SUVs speak to that. And the fact that they have gotten more fuel efficient, makes the decision that much easier for a lot of people. And when gas prices are low, they can justify it. I mean, of course, people are going to keep their car for a long period of time, but it seems to kind of go out the window, that logic, when gas prices are this low. People want larger vehicles.
Does this mean the pressure is off for manufacturers to keep working on more fuel efficient vehicles, or does this just mean we're going to see more trucks with greater fuel efficiency?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's still going to be pressure on automakers to produce vehicles with good fuel efficiency. I mean, there's one thing that seems to be apparent. It doesn't matter whether you're buying a full-size truck or you're buying a subcompact car. You want good fuel efficiency for that vehicle. And automakers, there's regulations in place that are going to, drive them to better the fuel economy of their vehicles. So there's that in place. But I think that for a while, the wisdom was, okay, if you want better fuel efficiency, you're going to have to go with a smaller car. And that seems to be challenged right now. People want, good fuel efficiency, but they want it in something that they also want to drive. Because not everyone, can have a compact car. People with families are, have that need for cargo capacity. They need a larger vehicle.
Now, looking specifically at models, are there models you can point to that did it particularly well?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that really we saw a lot of strength in smaller SUVs. The Honda CR-V was the best-selling SUV in the country in 2014. It sold over 300,000 units. That did relatively well, especially that segment in general. And also the Ford F-Series. It's kind of had a tough year because they just came out with a new one, and it's a big difference from where we were in the past, using an all-aluminum body. So they kind of had to conserve the inventory while their factory shut down, actually, to retool the new truck. So they were really conservative on their inventory in the latter half of the year, but still was the best-selling vehicle in the United States, and it has been for as long as I can remember. So that did well as well.
Now, let's say gas prices go back up. I mean, we expect them to have to boomerang at some point. How do you see that affecting the market?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when gas prices go up, people start, looking to downsize a bit. And I think when people are downsizing now, it seems to be that they're making better decisions for themselves. And what I mean by that is that it seemed like in 2008, when we had that significant gas price spike, all people wanted to do was go into small cars. And, to be honest, that didn't fit a lot of people's lifestyles. So people weren't happy with what they bought. And they were trading in large SUVs. They weren't getting a good, deal on the trade-in because, there wasn't a market for them at the time. So now it seems like people are a bit wiser. And if gas prices go up, maybe from, when they would have thought of a midsize SUV in the past, and now they may go for something smaller like a compact SUV. So I think a lot of that behavior will happen. And I think, green cars, hybrids, plug-in hybrids, electric vehicles didn't have a great 2014. So I think there'll be renewed interest when gas prices start to go up again.
Would you say that domestic auto sales are a pretty good reflector of the overall health of the country's economy?
Mm-hmm. I think that they're definitely a good measure. People that buy cars obviously have to feel good about their own economic situation and that economic situation at large. The interest rates have to be attractive. I mean, most people are buying on interest these days. A lot of people don't buy cash, and a lot of people also choose to lease. So I think the fact that they're committing to these large purchases that they're going to have to stick to over, a period of years shows that they feel good, and I think that makes a larger statement about the economy at large.
Looking ahead to 2015, do you see any surprises coming down the pike? Any newcomers, maybe like Tesla, who might make a splash?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tesla's had, for Tesla, a relatively quiet past few months. Of course, whatever they do seems to make big news. I mean, I think the thing for them a lot of people want to see, which is expected, is their SUV. That's had a lot of buzz, and I think that kind of when they show that and when that goes on sale, that's going to create definitely a lot of interest, really in that brand. So I think, a lot of people are kind of holding out to see what that's going to look like, because they really have kind of redefined that whole electric vehicle segment, that electric vehicles don't have to be appliances. They don't have to be, lacking in style. They can have tons of style, tons of performance, and, people seem to be gravitating to that and that brand. I mean, anything that they do seems to be widely interested by a lot of people.
Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking with Jessica Caldwell, senior analyst at Edmunds.com. The National Rifle Association was started with the goal of training people how to use guns. Today it's grown into one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, political lobby group in the country.
Supporters of gun control often point to the power of the NRA as the reason that politicians don't debate gun control even during public outcry in the aftermath of a shooting tragedy.
The United States has the highest rate of gun ownership in the world and one of the highest rates of gun violence in the developed world. According to data from 2010, there are about 85 gun deaths each day in the United States.
With us now to talk about how the NRA has become so influential is Frontline producer and reporter Jim Gilmore. His documentary, Guns Down, The Power of the NRA, airs tonight at 9 on your local public TV station. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So just looking back, since President Obama has taken office, a lot of shooting tragedies that captured national attention, Sandy Hook Elementary School, the shooting of Gabrielle Giffords, the Aurora, Colorado theater shootings, on top of the daily more common shooting deaths and suicides, non-mass shootings. What does the general trajectory look like, though, in terms of how the country and politicians respond to those high-profile incidents?
The numbers are getting higher. I think 2012 was the highest number of mass shootings ever. But the ability to get anything done is basically zilch in Washington. And that's what our film really looks at, is sort of the growth of the NRA over the past few decades and the way that Washington has dealt with the issue over the past couple of decades, especially through the years of the Clinton years as well as all the way up through the Obama years. And we take a look at that, and we kind of come to the conclusion that the NRA has won in Washington, and nothing more will probably change in Washington. So it's a pretty dire sort of conclusion that we have come to because of the power of, as you said, an organization that started out many years ago as just a group of hunters and sportsmen.
I want to look back at the group's history in a moment, but looking at its power today, how does that show itself? Why is the NRA so effective? Maybe some people say the most effective lobbying group in the country.
I mean, the people that we talk to, and we talk to a lot of gun control advocates as well as gun rights advocates, and we talk to past leadership of the NRA and past spokespeople for the NRA who talk about what they've been able to achieve. And the bottom line is that the membership of the NRA is just very, very supportive, very much there. This issue, Second Amendment rights, is their main issue, and they're willing to work against any changes in laws. They're willing to send money into the NRA when they feel that the NRA is representing what they believe. They're just very, very strong advocates that vote. What has happened in the past is those that think there should be more gun control laws coming through are people that are motivated after, for instance, a major shooting or something is on the front pages, at which point there's a lot of motivation to proceed and there's a lot of discussion on the front pages. But what has happened almost every single time, and what the NRA has learned, is that this passion dies out amongst the gun control advocates, while the passion amongst their advocates, the gun rights advocates, never goes away. I think as simple as that sounds, I think that's the truth.
Well, the NRA, as you point out in this documentary, was not always really a political organization. What did it look like before it turned more toward politics?
It really was a nonprofit organization for hunters and sportsmen. Back in the mid-70s to 77, they actually had a headquarters near Washington, but they wanted to move it out of Washington because they didn't want to be involved in the day-to-day politics of the issues. They wanted to be only about what was best for the sportsmen and you know, print their magazines that were talking about the latest technology, the latest guns and bullets and ways to information to use for hunting. But what happened in 77 was there was a changing of the guards. There was really a coup, and a much more politically active group came to power. One of the younger folks at that point was a man by the name of Wayne LaPierre, who is now the head of the organization, and has been so for many years now. They came to power, and they adjusted their views of what they should be. And what has happened is they have grown tremendously over the years because of this decision, and they've become amazingly powerful because they developed a lobbying arm which I think most people in Washington believe is the best, bar none, at lobbying for what they believe in. Other new lobbyists that come to Washington, in fact, study the way they work and how they activate their membership because they are so successful.
So what does a politician weigh before they decide to face off with the NRA?
They weigh votes and they weigh money. I mean, the way it's been described to us and by politicians and by some of the senators we've talked to is that when you're something I didn't quite understand, but when you're a politician, when you're a senator or a congressman, you take on certain issues, ones that got you elected, and some ones that you believe in strongly but you know are controversial. But most politicians will only take on a handful of controversial issues because otherwise they'll lose voters and they won't be elected. And unfortunately, there are very few real brave folk in Washington these days. And when you have to go to bat against such a powerful foe as the NRA, who is so good at at getting their voters out, it's so good at raising money, and is in and their PR almost perhaps is bigger than the actual reality. People just assume that if you go against them, that you will be defeated, and that counts for a lot in Washington.
Now, in your documentary, you set the stage for the 2000 elections. There were the horrible school shootings, the Columbine high school shootings, a backlash, efforts to pass federal gun reform, a tied vote in the Senate. Then Vice President Al Gore cast the deciding vote in support of legislation that ultimately failed in the House. And now
right.
Al Gore, candidate for president, runs afoul of the NRA. Here's a clip of then NRA leader Charlton Heston talking to members of the organization in the run-up to that election.
The race between George W. Bush and Al Gore. That's the last year that the gun issue played a critical role in American politics.
Now it was time to settle a score with a man who had broken that tie vote in the Senate, Al Gore.
I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
So as an iconic a moment for Charlton Heston as any movie he was ever in, how much of a role did NRA action play in that Bush-Gore election in 2000?
A lot. I mean, a very large part, if one believes both supporters and the folks that lost to them. What they do is they work on the edges. They're very clever at sort of where they bring in their forces, where they activate their the electorate. Al Gore lost his own state. He lost Tennessee. He lost West Virginia. He lost several states that he was expected to win in. And he lost by small margins, but he lost by big margins amongst those that own guns. I think Al Gore, if you asked him, would blame the NRA. If it hadn't been for the NRA, he probably would have won. They went out full bore against him because of that tiebreaker that he voted. Even though he really did not mention during the elections anything about the issue. In fact, he seemed to stay away from the issue quite a bit even before. And what the issue was, that law that was not passed, was all about closing loopholes in a bill, in the Brady bill, that had passed early on in the Clinton administration. Closing loopholes, which means the background checks that normally you get when you buy a gun in a gun store, you don't have to pass if you buy it in a gun show or over the internet at this point. A bill that at this point, back then as well, a majority of Americans, so close to 80%, 90% of Americans, believe is a good idea, and which about 74% of NRA members believe it was a good idea. But the NRA was totally against it, And when Al Gore runs for president, they went after him because of his involvement in trying to pass that bill.
As we wrap up, Jim, how much of the NRA's success is because of how they've operated as an organization versus how they reflect a real element of American culture that believes strongly in Second Amendment rights as a guarantee of freedom?
I think both. I mean, I think there is, you know, the numbers don't lie. I mean, a majority of Americans care much about rights and gun rights. Therefore, I think this debate will need to go on, not in Washington because it's basically a done deal in Washington, but I think at the state level, from state to state, which is where the action is at this point, this is going to be a very hot debate that will go on for many years to come.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Loved it. Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Frontline producer and reporter Jim Gilmore. His documentary, Gunned Down, The Power of the NRA, airs tonight at 9 on your local public television station.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We turn now to Monty Python and the Holy Grail for a bit of a silly beginning to a serious conversation about pain.
Now stand aside, worthy adversary.
'Tis but a scratch.
A scratch? Your arm's off.
No, it isn't.
Well, what's that then?
I've heard worse.
So the Black Knight can lose a limb without noticing the pain. It's just a flesh wound. For the rest of us in real life, pain isn't quite so easy to ignore.
But do we all experience pain in the same way? And does pain mean the same thing to us now as it did maybe to our ancestors a century or two ago? Well, our next guest digs into those questions in a new book and makes the case that the concept of pain is a lot more complicated than we might think.
Joanna Burke is professor of history at Birkbeck College at the University of London, and her latest book is The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. Joanna, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm really thrilled to be able to talk to you.
So I would think, you know, pain is pain. It's a physical process, a sensation we all experience in roughly the same way. But you say, no, why not?
Well, this is what I had assumed as well. I mean, pain is something universal. It's physiological. And so when I started this project, I actually thought, like you do, that, you know, it's all the same. What is fascinating is if we look into the past, 18th century to the present, we see that the way people understood pain and also the way they experienced it actually changes dramatically over time, depending on what they think pain is and how they think they ought to be responding to it.
We'll get into that compare and contrast with the past in a bit, but one difficulty you point out that seems universal is the difficulty of putting pain into words, into communicating what it feels like to other people.
Look, Rob, you know, this is exactly why I started working on this book on pain. Basically, I don't actually tell the story in the book itself, but I was in hospital after a serious operation, and my morphine pump wasn't working. I was pushing it, and it just wasn't working. And I tried to distract myself. And so I started reading a book that someone had given me by Virginia Woolf called On Being Ill. She wrote it a long time ago, and it was fascinating, because in that book, she tells a story about how pain is incommunicable, it's outside of language, etc., etc. And my partner came to visit me, and I remember very excitingly telling him about this book, etc. And I noticed his face kind of changed a little bit. And I said, am I doing something wrong? And he said, Joanna, you have been talking for an entire hour about how pain is impossible to communicate and beyond language. An entire hour I was talking about it. And he said, you know, maybe it's not the fact that pain is beyond language and incapable of being communicated, but that people don't want to listen. And people, you know, don't want to hear this about other people's pain. And that got me really interested in pain, because basically, people in pain, obviously, they struggle to communicate it, but they do all the time, and they do so using very rich metaphorical languages, and I just find that really, really interesting.
Well, let's get into how that language has changed over time, and one thing that surprised me reading your book is, in some cases, pain is viewed as a positive experience, an opportunity either for religious reasons or reasons of personal growth. How has pain been perceived as a good thing?
Well, actually, in most of history, pain has been perceived as a good thing. I mean, clearly, in highly religious, highly devout societies and cultures and periods of time, you know, pain was something that was given by God. It was a gift by a loving God who was trying to teach us something, trying to teach us about how we ought to behave, how we, you know, what is wrong when we are sinning. We are inflicted by it, and it's inflicted by a loving God to teach us. Pain has also, in the past, widely been seen as something that creates a better person. It creates a person who is sympathetic, for example, to other people in pain. So pain is constructive. It creates communities. There's also, of course, the idea that, well, you suffer in this world so you don't have to suffer in the next. So even after, in Britain and America, we have effective painkillers, basically middle of the 19th century, effective painkillers, so a lot of people refused to take them on the grounds that this would make them less better people. It wouldn't, you know, they would be lesser people, that somehow you had to learn from this pain. And even people who were not Christians, you know, understood pain as something positive because, of course, of its evolutionary importance. So even if you don't believe in a God, you believe maybe in evolution, that, you know, pain is something that teaches you how you ought to react.
Right.
Now,
so
that all changes dramatically with painkillers.
There's this huge time lag between the potential to put somebody under for something like, you know, even an amputation, decades before people actually start using it reliably.
Exactly. So even when we have, you know, chloroform and ether, et cetera, people didn't use them or didn't want to use them. And I think we really have to note here that, of course, these kind of painkillers were given to certain people more than other people. So we have very, very good evidence, for example, that minority groups, African Americans, the poor, were much less likely to be given chloroform in operations than other members of society. So there is this kind of real imbalance, this kind of view that certain people actually don't really need painkillers.
Now, things have changed. I recently had some surgery myself, and the attitudes you just described were not my attitude. I did not welcome pain as a character-building experience. When did this change happen between thinking of pain as a positive to thinking of pain as something that can, and I guess more importantly, should be controlled when it's possible?
Well, it really happens around the 1870s. So, you know, mid-1840s, you get, you know, effective pain relief, but it takes a long time for it to really hit in. And really, it's the 1870s where combination of education, acceptance of these new technologies for relieving pain, declining religious beliefs, you get the idea all of a sudden that pain is actually a bad thing. It's something that needs to be fought. So, you know, in previous centuries, the idea is that you submit to pain because it's meant to teach you something, or you submit to it, or you even embrace it as something positive. By the 1870s, that's definitely out of fashion, and you're supposed to sort of don your armor and fight it, you know, with all guns blazing. So you get the increase of military metaphors coming in to the way people talk about pain.
There's still a sense that there's a positive in enduring pain, stoically, not whining, not complaining, along with the talk of, hey, no, deal with pain. It's real and significant. How important is that conflict now in the present day?
I think we still have this stoical attitude. I mean, you know, when I mentioned earlier I was in hospital in great pain and my morphine pump wasn't working, you know, I didn't want to disturb the nurse. I
don't want to be a bother.
I distracted myself, you know, so that's a kind of stoical thing, which still, of course, has high value. And, of course, high value also for certain people more than other people. So this idea of women in childbirth, for example, should actually, you know, bear their pain in a stoical manner is something that's still very, very strong in our society.
Well, we're starting to understand or try to understand what pain is more with the neural imaging and understanding of the way our nervous systems work. Do we know what pain is now?
We don't really know what pain is. I mean, You know, pain is pain is pain. What a person says is pain is painful. And I think this is an important thing that physicians and scientists also recognize, that, you know, what a person finds painful is very individual. It's affected by not only their physiology, but also by a huge range of environmental, social attitudes and contexts. I mean, for example, there was a really interesting study done during the Second World War by someone called Beecher, an American physician called Beecher, who actually examined, him and his team, hundreds of men who had extremely severe injuries after combat in Italy. And what he discovered is that the majority of these patients, when asked, "Are you in pain?" said, "No, I'm not." When they were, and these are people who had lost their limbs, I mean, very, very serious injuries. And when they were asked, "Do you want pain relief?" In other words, reminding them that it was there if they wanted it, they said, "No, that's fine. I'm not in particular pain." But if someone mistakenly stood on their foot or gave them an injection in a clumsy way, they would say, "Ouch." So, you know, and what he concluded, he came back to America and he did similar experiments with patients in emergency wards and hospitals, and all of them were in extreme pain. So the issue he came, the decision, this thing he came to, conclusion he came to was that, of course, for the men on the beachhead waiting with severe wounds, you know, limblessness, etc., for them, everything in front of them was positive. They were going onto the ship and they were going back and they would be cured, they would be fixed. But of course, for the people in the emergency ward in America, of course, the accident was just the beginning of disaster. So they felt pain a lot more than, of course, the men on the beachhead. So in other words, emotions have a really major effect on whether we actually feel pain and the extent to which we feel it.
We're talking to Joanna Burke about her new book, The Story of Pain. She makes the case that pain isn't experienced the same way by all people, and that our understanding, our interpretation of pain has changed over time.
And you can join the conversation. Do you think that pain is a universal, the same for everyone? Do you see a generational difference in the way that we deal with pain? And when you're dealing with pain, do you try to shrug it off and keep it to yourself, or do you get help and maybe seek out a sympathetic ear? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Joanna Burke, author of The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. She says pain isn't experienced in the same way by all people, and the meaning of pain has been changing over the past couple of centuries.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this in your own life? We experience pain differently, the way we talk about it maybe affects the way we feel it. And if you've ever had to use that 1 to 10 pain chart at the doctor's office or the hospital, are you stumped? Because you're like me, you don't know what 10 means exactly. No basis for comparison. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers right away, actually. We've got Eric on the line in Waukesha. Eric, hi.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. What do you got for us, Eric?
Let's see. At the young age of 19, I'm 35 right now, I was in a car accident. Someone pulled out in front of me, which left my neck fused in two places and a few positive hernia discs. I know a lot of people that sit around and they're in pain with their neck fusion, but when I start to become in pain, it actually makes me get up and move. Every time I start feeling that, I use it as a trigger. So therefore, after my surgery, I became a healthier person, because if I start getting a headache or that pain starts to kick in, I know I need to eat, I'm going to need to sleep, I need to exercise. So I've completely changed my health and my diet just around my pain. And, you know, in ways, I'm definitely a healthier person with it.
Interesting, Eric. Thanks a lot for sharing your story. So that's one approach, one response, Joanna. Pain is a trigger that we need to do something a little differently.
Yeah, and I think, Eric, you've got a really interesting point there. You know, pain is something obviously no one ever wants, but, you know, pain is something that we can use in positive ways. What I found in researching and writing this history of pain is that it was really fascinating to see how people like you, but people in the past, managed to use their pain in ways that actually forged better lives for themselves, but also for other people. And I think that's a lovely, lovely message for all of us.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Melody now in Ferryville. Hi, Melody.
Hi. I'd like to comment on the fact that I worked in a General Motors factory. I worked for 36 years. I started when I was 12. Subsequently, I've lost my back, and I've abused my wrist and my back, and I still have problems with it. I did work 36 years, and I cried at my Social Security disability hearing because the last thing I wanted to do was leave work. I felt like nothing. I felt like I was a loser. I have to be on pain medication just to do my daily tasks. What's sad now is that it seems like there's such a stigma out there. If you're on pain medications, you're a drug addict. Having to go to Walmart, pick up your prescription, have to show your ID and sign something because the DEA is watching you closely. It is so embarrassing. I don't dare let my friends, family, or grandchildren know I'm on pain medication.
Melody, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm sorry for your story, and good luck to you. Joanna, though, this is not an uncommon theme. We've got these pain medications. Some cases are encouraged to use them, but there's this love-hate relationship, too.
Yeah, this is something that really infuriates me. And the last chapter of the book deals exactly with what you're suffering. You know, the idea, it's vulgar, it's unimaginably awful. The idea that people in pain should not get access to this medication that can help you, and not only medication, of course, techniques, technologies, etc., that can help you, is absolutely horrific. And the stigma associated with taking pain medication is there and really needs to be tackled. You know, the idea that someone in pain would become addicted to the medication is ridiculous. There is a huge amount of evidence, scientific evidence, that this does not happen. And indeed, there's a vast amount of scientific evidence that if people in pain actually are allowed to regulate their own pain through medication, they will actually take less. They end up taking fewer pain medication than if they are prescribed. You know, it's a really a terrible state of affairs that people are not given relief when they patently need it.
Well, and also Melody has something, real pain that came from probably repetitive work over the years, but it's not visible. It's not an accident with scars. It's not a war wound. Do she and maybe people who suffer from chronic pain syndromes have a stigma that and we don't take their pain seriously?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we always want to see proof of their pain. And this is something that it's a major problem in our society. And this is why I think we as a society need to actually have an argument, a debate about chronic pain. You know, something like 40% of Americans experience chronic pain conditions. This is it's a vast problem in all of our societies. And we need to have a conversation about that. And what I find, obscene, one of the many things I find obscene is, of course, that politicians who don't have these chronic pain conditions, you know, very easily sort of legislate against medication being given. But of course, as soon as they or their loved ones become a victim or suffer chronic pain, of course, they change their mind. And I just think that that is obscene.
Melody, again, good luck to you, and thanks for sharing your story. We've got John now on the line in Windsor. John, hi.
Yeah, about 6 years ago, I had knee replacement surgery. Both of my knees replaced. I was 50 years old. Now, I had my first knee surgery at 16, my second at 22, my third at 25. And at that time, the doc told me that you're going to eventually have to have a knee replacement surgery. So I refused, I love riding bike. And at the time, I thought, if I have the knee replacement surgery, that's going to be the end of it. So I continued to do that for 30 years, and until one of my coworkers said, John, would you please go to the doctor and talk to him about your knees? And I'm like, why? And they said, because it's painful to watch you walk. Mm-hmm. And so I did. The doc told me I had to have knee replacement surgery. All of a sudden, I was in pain. So I think, what you're talking about a little bit earlier where, you see the pain that you're in, and you want to live life, and so you're not going to experience the pain because, you know, it's, you know, I think that that's a huge thing.
John, thanks a lot for the call. As we're starting to wrap up, Joanna, we have a lot of ways in our lives now that we have the possibility of relieving pain, whether it's a pain medication or a surgery that might fix our knees. How much has that changed our perception of what pain is?
Clearly, the fact that there are ways around pain now, there are many more options that we can take, makes pain less acceptable to us. But I think really the message that really has to come across is that the problem is not really with the pain patient. The problem is with those around the patient, the person suffering pain, who dismiss pain or who don't believe in it in the first place or who want to sort of shut it out of their lives. I think the problem is with witnesses to pain as opposed to people in pain themselves. We really have to take pain, people who say that they are suffering, we have to take them seriously. And I actually don't think we're doing that right now.
So a sympathetic ear can be a bit of pain treatment in itself.
Absolutely. You know, and the whole thing about placebo effect and everything, that we have really good scientific evidence that people who are in loving relationships or loving communities, who are believed, who can talk about what they're experiencing, what they're suffering, that they actually manage both to feel better about their pain, but also to turn around in some way that pain experience into something that can be used in a much more positive way, as our first caller was doing.
We'll leave it there. Joanna, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Really enjoyed talking to you.
That's Joanna Burke. Her new book is The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers.
Some crossover controversy in the worlds of sports and politics this weekend as New Jersey governor and possible presidential candidate Chris Christie was spotted in Dallas with the Dallas Cowboys owner rooting for their team. And that doesn't really play that well in New Jersey.
Christie is a fan of the Cowboys. He hasn't made that a secret. He has caught flack back home, though. So what's it like to be a fan in hostile territory? We've got our resident expert on the subject. Producer Chris Molina lives this experience every day. Hey, Chris.
Yeah, hey, Rob. I am a fan of a team that is not the Green Bay Packers, a team that is a direct
rival. It's worse
rival.
Than just that. It's just not Packers.
It is a direct rival of the Green Bay Packers. I'm not sure I want to say which team it is, but there are only a couple options out there. So
it rhymes with Chicago Rares. Do you catch a lot of flack here in Wisconsin for this?
You know, I do catch some flack, but I think the hardest part for me is, you know, Monday morning when everyone is exuberant because the Packers blew out another opponent by 45 points where my team lost by 45 points. You know, it's an ongoing struggle every week, and some people say, well, why don't you just convert and be a Packers fan? You can't do that.
Anyone else feeling this, shoot us a message on the Central Time Facebook page. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thanks. Go Bears.